Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she too can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, I got a podcast I want to tell you about. It's a new show. It's called We Love You, and So Can You. And if you are someone who occasionally feels down, i.e. if you are anyone in the world, if you're a human being, there might be something for you to get out of the show. It's part reality show, part self-love school. If you know the show by the book, you're going to love this new one. It's also hosted by Kristen Meinzer and Jolenta Greenberg. And on the show, they send listeners on their own self-help journeys and help them make over some huge part of their life. Maybe it's jumping back into the dating world. Maybe it's starting a new career. Maybe it's just not feeling like a total schmuck all the time. All kinds of things are featured on the show, all kinds of people. You'll have fun. You'll laugh. You'll maybe cry. So go listen to We Love You and So Can You in this podcast app. You are currently listening to the show. And another show that you could check out is called You Can't Make This Up. It's a podcast done by Netflix. It's a companion to all the incredible documentaries that Netflix does. Each episode features a rotating interviewer talking with someone involved in the making of a documentary. It's a monthly show, monthly podcast. The August episode is The Great Hack. And this interview you're about to hear actually appeared on You Can't Make This Up. Aaron was one of the interviewers, and we just thought that it totally made sense for the long form audience too. So go check out those two shows. But for now, here's our show.
Hello and welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'm here with Evan Ratliff, returned, and Max Linsky. Hey, team.
Hey, you guys. Evan, it's good to have you back, man.
Thank you. It's great to be with you guys. Aaron, who's on the show?
This one is kind of a dream interview for me, although it is a little bit off the beaten path of this show. It's a documentary filmmaker. His name is Jean-Xavier de Lestrade. Please, please send me all of the email about my pronunciation of his name. He is French. Also, incredible filmmaker behind The Staircase, which I think most people are familiar with now, although when I saw it many years ago, it was a total unknown to me. And it's a true crime documentary series that came out in 2004 about the murder trial of Michael Peterson and whether his wife was indeed murdered by him or fell down the stairs. There's so, so much more to the story than that, but I won't give any of it away other than to say he returned to do an update on the series in 2013, and then Netflix picked up another few updates on the story in 2018. If you have not seen the series, I would say start from the very beginning, book a dozen or so hours of time, and then listen to this interview. But it's pretty fascinating to talk to someone who has followed a single story for this long and this deeply to the point where he is a pretty major figure in the story.
Man, I'm excited about this one. I feel like we should start having more documentary filmmakers on the show.
I'm game.
I feel like the both the true crime boom and all these streaming services going pretty heavy on the documentaries means there's more documentary stuff to talk about than ever. So if you have a documentary filmmaker you'd like to hear on the show, send us an email.
Yeah, listeners, hold us to this.
@longform.org.
If we just say something on the intro like, yeah, we should have more documentary filmmakers, and then we never do it, send us an email and tell us we're assholes.
About to get a lot of email.
If you've got to send a lot of email, there's no better way to do it than with MailChimp. You can't be running a email newsletter from your Gmail box. It won't work. You need a dedicated, efficient, fairly priced email newsletter service like MailChimp. We appreciate them for bringing us this show. And also, read the summer.
Yeah, we appreciate them for being such fine people who support the arts. They're doing a thing this summer. It's called Read This Summer. Every year, they select an author. This year, it's Jenna Wortham, who brings a group of writers to the Decatur Book Festival. That's over Labor Day weekend in Atlanta. But if you're looking for something to read, Jenna has an incredible list of books. Go check it out. Go to readthissummer.com.
I personally am going to be checking out the writers that Jenna selected at the Decatur Book Festival.
Evan Ratliff.
In my hometown.
Evan will be there too. Go see Jenna's crew. Go see Evan. And thank MailChimp. They made it all possible.
And now here's Aaron with Jean Xavier de Lestrade.
The first movie of yours that was distributed in America is Murder on a Sunday Morning. But I know from your Wikipedia page that you had done stuff before then. What drew you to documentary filmmaking in the first place?
I think the very first documentary I did was just before Madonna Sunday Morning. It was a film about a young lawyer, a French woman, who went to Rwanda to defend people who were accused of genocide. Because at the time, it was in 2000, at the time there was no lawyer in Rwanda to defend the people accused of genocide. And so many people from outside the country were going there to defend these people. And so I followed during 3 months a very young defense lawyer in her work, and to watch how you can defend this kind of people accused of having killed so many, many, many people. And that was very, very interesting.
You seem to gravitate towards lawyers as the subject of your movie. I mean, you could even say that The Staircase is equally about David Rudolph as it is about Michael Peterson. What fascinates you about lawyers, and why are they good subjects for films?
Well, in fact, I have a law degree. I studied law during 4 years in college, and that was only after having that law degree that I did journalism studies, and I have been interested in documentaries and cinema. But I have always been very focused or interested in the justice system, because I think the justice system is one of the best way to look into a democracy, how that democracy is working or not working. And I try to do it in France, but in France it's very, very difficult to shoot inside a courtroom, to follow lawyers. And so I went to the States, and you can say that United States are the biggest democracy in the world. And just to challenge that title, in a way, I wanted to look at it through the justice system, how it works, and is it fair or not?
What were your impressions when you first set foot in an American courtroom? What were the biggest surprises for you as you started to spend time around the American justice system?
the biggest surprise is, and the biggest difference between a courtroom in Europe, or especially in France or Italy or Spain, than in the US. In France, you get the sense that in a courtroom, the judge is there to try to find the truth, in a way. And it's not, of course, always easy. But that's the goal. When you go in a US courtroom, you immediately get the sense that it's not really about truth. It's more about a story against another story. It's more about storytelling, in fact. And that's why it's so great for filmmakers, because in one hand, you have the DA story. In the other hand, you have the defense lawyer story. And especially in Michael Peterson's case, the DA was saying, okay, it's a murder. And the defense lawyer, David Rudolph, were saying, no, it's an accident, a fall down the stairs. So in a way, it's maybe the more compelling story or the more believable story by the jury will win. But at the end, we don't know if it's the truth or not. And it's a controversial system.
For you personally, what made you make the switch from a law path to a journalism and then a documentary path? Or why did you not become a lawyer yourself?
Well, because when I was a child, I was dreaming that one day I will tell stories with a camera. And but because my parents didn't really understand that desire, that I studied first law, but I always kept in mind that I wanted to do cinema, I wanted to do documentaries, I wanted to write dramas, and that was really my deepest desire. So the switch was quite easy, but I have to convince my parents that they had to pay 2 more years in college.
Did you have filmmakers whose work you were like, this is the kind of stuff I want to do? Because at the time, like this kind of long form documentary series, there weren't a ton of them out there. Someone camping out in a courtroom for years filming. What were your inspirations as you launched a documentary career?
Well, in France, we have a very, very talented documentary filmmaker. His name is Raymond Depardon, and it's Cinéma Vérité. And at some point, he tried to put his camera inside a courtroom, and he did one or two films about the justice system in France, and that was very inspiring. And in the US, you have Wiseman. I have watched all Wiseman movies, and that was also very, very inspiring. His patience, the ways he look at the institution, how the institution are working or not working. I remember, for example, he did documentaries about the police in Kansas City. He did documentaries about the health system. He did documentary about a housing project. It has been very, very inspiring.
How did the Michael Peterson story first come to you? How did you become aware of it?
Well, that's a long story, but I'll try to tell you in a short way. In fact, Murder on a Sunday Morning was in part produced by HBO. And HBO was very happy with Murder on a Sunday Morning. And they really wanted to do another movie, a little bit like based on a true story, legal system. And they asked me if I agreed to do another movie like that. And I have to say that at the beginning, I said no, because it's so difficult to find a very good story. And because when we start, you never know what will happen. And we, in a way, we were a little bit lucky with Murder on a Sunday Morning. And when you have to convoke the luck twice, it's becoming difficult. But they were very, they put a pressure and say, okay, we really want another movie and try at least to find a story. And we had a team, a kind of crew all around the States, maybe like 15 people. Most of them were journalists, and they were looking at in the courtroom, in the newspaper, everywhere to find a case that could be interesting for me. And what I said to them was very simple, because Murder on a Sunday Morning was the case about a young African-American teenager who had been accused of having killed a woman, and the mobile was about drug. And I wanted to find a case who would be the opposite of Murder on a Sunday Morning. So I told the people that I wanted a case about a white guy, wealthy, known in his own community, and a man was able to pay a private defense lawyer. And that was mainly the starting point. And it took, maybe we reviewed at least 400 different cases. And suddenly, in January 2002, a journalist from North Carolina sent us a mail in Paris, and the mail was very simple, two lines. I have a case, a novelist, Michael Peterson, is accused of having killed his wife. He's well known. He ran to be mayor in Durham, and his lawyer is David Rudolph, who is a very good lawyer. He's saying it's an accident. And that's all. So, well, interesting. We took a flight and we went to meet David Rudolph first. And the day after David Rudolph, we met with Michael Peterson. And first of all, David Rudolph seems to be a very good character, very good lawyer, smart, and very open, and that was a good start. And so the day after, we met with Michael Peterson, and Michael Peterson appeared to be also a very good character. Not so charming than David Rudolph, but you could immediately feel that there was like a mystery around this guy, something you couldn't catch immediately. You could feel that there was a strong intuition I had that there was like ghost in the room when you were with him. And at some point, you have to trust your intuition or your deep feeling. And so I said, okay, we are going to start to shoot. And we'll see in a month if there is a story or not. And at the beginning, when we start shooting, the goal was to do a 2 hours documentary, like Murder on a Sunday Morning. Nobody was talking about doing a series, a documentary series, because it didn't exist at the time. And there was no documentary series, true crime documentary series. So we start shooting, and I thought that in 6 months, the shooting of the documentary have been finished, but we stay 22 months.
So at the front end of these 22 months, you're in Durham, North Carolina, very specific region of America. What did people make of a Frenchman with a camera crew pushing its way into the courtroom each morning, interviewing people in the community? How did people receive you?
That was very interesting, because people were very surprised. they were keep asking why a French documentary crew is staying there and following that case. Well, the case is quite interesting, okay, but why did you choose that case? Why did you choose Durham? Why are you there? But they were quite open. But at the same time, in 2002, 2003, that was the beginning of the Iraqi war. And if you remember, at the time, the fries, when you were going to a restaurant, there was always French fries.
Freedom fries.
Yes, and it became freedom fries because the French people were not there, were not with the Bush administration going to war against Iraq. And so people were quite open, but they were looking at us not so friendly. But mainly it was a surprise. Why are you staying there? Why you have no life? But the judge have been very open to us and very nice because he allowed us really to shoot exactly like I had in mind where I wanted to put the three cameras I wanted inside the courtroom. He allowed us to do that, and that was really a key factor in the way we shoot the trial, and that was very important.
This story has multiple giant twists in it. I think probably the biggest one for me was the revelation of this other woman who had died after falling down the stairs. I wonder if you could tell me emotionally for you when this project that, as you said, was supposed to be 6 months long, when a giant, giant twist comes in like that, that it's going to totally change the trial and the story you're telling. How did that feel for you as the filmmaker? Are you excited? Are you dreading how much longer you're going to have to film?
Both, exactly. When we start shooting, obviously we had no clue about what will happen, and especially about the death of Elisabeth Radcliffe in Germany 17 years ago. We didn't know. In fact, we learned about that with the prosecution. Because at the beginning, my goal was to shoot. I didn't really wanted to do a documentary film about only about the defense system or the defense lawyers. I really wanted to look at the case, the way the justice system will treat Michael Peterson. And so at the beginning, they allowed us to shoot and to work with them. And at some point, because they really wanted us to know, to believe that Michael Peterson was guilty, they said to us, but you don't know about the death of Elisabeth Radcliffe. Do you know how she died? No, I don't know, but I'm sure you are going to tell me and it will be interesting. And that's the way we learn. And of course, we fell down from the chair. I don't know if you said that in English, but that was obviously that changed all the perspective of the documentary. I knew at that point that I couldn't tell the story in 2 hours. We had so good material that I knew that we had to create a new format, to invent a new format, but not only a two-hour documentary.
What has it been like in the years since the original episodes came out, seeing, particularly in the last few years, this boom in true crime storytelling, which often takes the format that you pioneered with The Staircase, of the sort of multiple episode. Mm-hmm. There's something that you don't know at the beginning that's really going to change your views midway.
Well, that was really interesting. And to tell you the truth, when we came back to HBO at the end of the shooting and we told them, we can't do a two-hour documentary. It has to be an 8-hour documentary film. and at the time, Sheila Nevins was the head of documentary in HBO. And wow, she said, no way, no way, it's impossible. No, you have to tell the story in 2 hours. I'm sure you can do it. And I told her, yes, of course, you always can cut, but you can't imagine what we have shot. And we need to do it in 8 hours. That's the right format. We have to do it. And HBO said, no way. And so we have to withdraw from HBO to find other support. And that was a very risky path. That was, can you imagine to say no to HBO?
And well, there weren't a lot of alternatives at the time either, I would think.
Exactly. Like
there weren't the 19 different streaming services that you could go to.
Exactly. And that was quite difficult. And we put our own little production in risk. And but I knew, I was totally convinced that there was only one way to tell that story. And we will convince many broadcasters all around the world to buy the 8-hour documentary and to run it in that format. And thanks, I don't know who, but thanks, we succeed. Yes, to really answer to your question, today it's more easier to find a place to sell this kind of long-term documentary series. And it's, I think, I'm quite happy that to be able to watch Making a Murderer, to watch The Jinx, to watch The Keepers. Of course, the huge difference, because it's very difficult to do a good documentary series, because as I said, when you start filming, you don't know what will happen. And you never can be really sure that you will get all the material to do a 6 hours, 8 hours, or 10 hours documentary series. And if you take Making a Murderer, in fact, the two filmmakers, they start shooting during months and years before going to Netflix and saying, well, I think we had a very good show. and the difficulties now, it's quite difficult to say, okay, we are going to start to shoot and I will deliver to you a very strong 8-hour documentary series, because that's quite difficult to... Or if you knew the end before starting shooting, that something is wrong there. You can't. And so I know to shape a documentary series like a drama, that's, I think, it's good. It's very exciting. And when we cut Staircase, it was really, really exciting to do it as a drama. But we really had the material to do it and to stay really in the rules of a documentary film. That, of course, you are not staging anything. You are shooting what it's in front of your camera. And that's very important. And you always have to keep that in mind. It's cinema verite. And the beauty of the documentary, it's because you are capturing the life.
That must have gotten more difficult as you became more and more intimate with David Rudolph and Michael Peterson. I mean, these are people that you've now known for going on 15, 20 years. particularly as you came back to the film now, now that these people are a big part of your life, a big part of your career, were there additional challenges in feeling like, oh, I'm not staging this or I'm not influencing it simply by being here?
Yes, it's a very good question, because the main question about documentary is the point of view and the distance you keep between you, filmmaker, and the subject. And you have always to keep the right distance. And during the last 5 years of shooting, I have to say, with Michael Peterson, with David Rudolph, it has been more and more difficult to keep the right distance. Because, of course, as you said, we, in a way, we were friends, and it was really difficult to tell them, okay, you are seeing me as a friend, but I have also a film to do. And if I really want to shoot and to do a good film, I have to keep the right distance. And I can't be your friend. Or I may be your friend, but I have always to keep in mind that when I'm doing an interview of Michael Peterson, that that guy who is in front of me may have killed his wife. And I don't know that. But I have always to keep that in my mind until the end, because that distance is really, really, really important. And to stay at the right distance during 15 years has been quite difficult.
Did the fact that the case had become famous make it different when you returned to film in the courtroom during Peterson's Alford plea? Like, I was unaware of this case when it was happening the first time. Now, because of the success of the original Staircase, this is a big case that people are interested in. The media is interested in it. It's a big deal, it seems like, for the local prosecutors in Durham. Like, this is their famous case. How did that change your filmmaking as you returned to the story?
Well, of course. And when we came back in December 2011, we were surprised because, in a way, now we were part of the story. We were not just watching the story, filming the story, but we were in the story too. And David Rudolph asked us some clips, and he have shown during the hearing in 2011 clips that we have shot 8 years before. And so we were filming David Rudolph showing some images we shot. And yes, we were, in a way, we were part of the story. And in 2014, in 2016 and 17, and especially in 17, during the last appearance of Michael Peterson in the courtroom, of course, everyone were looking at us as we should have been there. We had to be there. That the judge, the DA, Michael Peterson, or David Rudolph, in a way, their agenda were set up to be sure that we could be present in North Carolina to shoot the last hearing. And that's why also Candace, Kathleen's sister, at the last hearing when she spoke about the film, about the documentary film, about us, about the way we supposedly have treated her. And of course, I kept that testimony in the film because that was important, because we were in everyone's mind, in all the characters of the story. And yes, as I said, we were totally part of the story.
How do you feel when, I'm assuming this happens, people approach you and want to discuss whether Michael Peterson is guilty or not? What's it like for you, not with a camera running, but just in your day-to-day life when people have seen The Staircase and want to talk about the guilt or innocence of its main character with the person who spent many years with him?
Maybe I have heard the question, what do you think? What do you really believe? What is your deep conviction about the case, about Michael Peterson? I've heard that question maybe 500 times. because of course, and I can understand, I spent 15 years, more than 15 years, with Michael Peterson. And during the first 8 years of the case, I don't remember a day where I didn't ask myself that question. And I became really obsessed by what happened that night. What happened to Kathleen Peterson? It's really a mystery, but I really want to understand. I really want to know. And I'm sure I will know what happened. But at the end, no, I don't know. And I have to live with that. And that's also the beauty of life, that sometimes there are still mysteries and you don't know. So when people are asking me, what is your conviction? Why do you know? Why do you feel? I have to say maybe that I'm not sure that I know more today than I knew the first day I met him. And it's maybe incredible to say that, but I really don't know. And of course, I will feel more comfortable if he is innocent, because we spent so many hours, so many days, so many weeks together, and I never really got the feeling that he could have killed Kathleen, because if it's a murder, it's really a barbaric murder. If it's a murder, he had to kill her in a very barbaric manner. It's not just you push someone in the stairs. No, you beat someone until the death. And, well, it's quite really difficult to believe that Michael Peterson could have done that. But, again, I was not there that night, and it's really difficult to know someone very well and to say, I know he didn't do it. No, that's impossible to say that. So we have to live with that mystery.
Well, it speaks to the limitations of the justice system itself that you could have dedicated 15 years to this and been there, seen everything, and you still feel like, I'm not sure I know any more about his guilt than I did the day I met him. When you've shown this these films internationally, outside of the U.S., do you get different reactions from non-Americans than Americans?
Yes, sometimes the reaction of people outside the U.S., there are some more criticism against the U.S. legal system, because what do you see? You see a guy who spent $800,000 to defend himself, and well, he has been found guilty, and he has been found guilty because maybe the main character of the prosecution lied inside the courtroom and perjured himself. Wow. So you have someone who spent, again, $800,000. He spent 8 years in prison. And why? Because someone lied, and someone, prosecution expert, someone who you are supposed to trust, someone like him. And he lied, and that's why you spend 8 years in prison. And at the end, well, what do you get? You get a deal where you have to plead guilty. But you plead guilty and you are not guilty. Well, 15 years for that. Okay. And the state spent what? Spent maybe $1 or $2 million. And in the other hand, you will have people who are saying, okay, but look at it. The system works because, okay, a mistake has been made, but the mistake has been repaired. Okay, Michael Peterson has been released. Yes, he spent 8 years in prison, but there is no perfect system and justice has been done. So it's really interesting to hear what people have to say. And of course, the reaction may have a little bit different outside than in the U.S.
You described murder on a Sunday morning as, you know, getting lucky in a way, and or like lightning striking. And clearly, you got lucky again with The Staircase and getting a story that could extend over a decade. What are you doing now? Are you looking for another, a third lightning strike? Or
well, to tell you that really what happened, that after the end of the first 8 hours of Staircase in 2005, when I really said I finished the first 8 hours of Staircase, I am done with documentaries. I am done. I can't do it anymore because it's too stressful. It's been really difficult. And so I moved to drama. I wrote scripts and I shot different drama for the theater and the feature film and drama for television. But Staircase was the only documentary I was following. I accept to follow, of course. But we, in the last 2 years, I said to myself, okay, maybe it's time to go back and to look at maybe another story, but not as a director, but maybe as a executive producer. And we try to find a story to do a documentary series. And we find a story in Boston. We start shooting 2 years ago. And nothing what we were expecting happened. Nothing at all. And we were supposed to do 8 hours. It may be difficult to do the 8 hours we were supposed to do because that's the life of a documentary storyteller. Again, you never can be sure what will happen, and especially in the justice system. And also because you are not anymore just short, little French crew with three people going to Durham, but you are someone who is known, and of course it changed things. Today, when I go to see lawyers or prosecutor or a judge in the U.S., they are more, maybe more, not so more open to us.
Yeah, I would think that as true crime becomes more popular as a media format, that ultimately prosecutors may say having a documentary film about this case is inherently to the benefit of the defense, even if the film is fair.
Yes.
Simply the attention is helpful for a defendant.
Yeah, yeah. We had a case. We wanted to shoot a case, a very interesting case, and we start shooting. And because the prosecution, they knew we were shooting, they preferred to drop the case than to go to trial. And they dropped the case.
So they ruined your documentary while helping out the person you were making the documentary about.
Exactly.
Wow. I had not even thought about that potential eventuality. For you, there's been the first 8 hours of The Staircase, and then you did the first update, and now the final update, in which Michael Peterson is now out of jail, which I would think means that was the last one, unless, I mean, never say never, I guess, with a story like this. But assuming that you are done mm-hmm. with The Staircase, how is it to say goodbye to this? Is it still something you think about? Do you stay in touch with any of the people?
Yes, yes, of course. I stay in contact with David Rudolph. I've seen him 3 times since last July, in fact. And I kept in touch with Michael Peterson. He's still living in Durham in the same apartment. And the last day of shooting, I knew that was the last day of shooting. And of course, there was mixed feeling there. There was a feeling of relief, a huge relief, because I felt I was tied to the case. I was tied to these characters. I knew I had to do it. And the fact that it was finished, it was a huge relief. But also there was kind of sadness too, because I didn't know. I knew maybe I will never see again Michael Peterson or other people. And that was a kind of really joyful and sad moment, of course. But again, huge relief.
Thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you. That was great to talk to you.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thank you very much to Jean-Xavier de Lestrade. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Thank you to our editor, Janelle Pfeiffer. Thank you to our intern, Louisa Garbowit. And of course, thank you to the incredible people who help make this show possible at MailChimp and Pit Writers. You can always send us an email, podcast@longform.org. We totally appreciate it if anyone would rate us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you see us, rate us, leave a review. It helps people find out about the show, which is a good thing. We'll see you next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon, taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.